This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear more about the Oceana Dunes State Vehicular Recreation Area. It's been a deadly year for the park, and some want to change the rules about driving on the beach there. Others don't want to lose that access, and some see it as important revenue for San Luis Obispo County.
Our county is dependent on tourism and the economy. The economic impact of losing this recreational area would no doubt hurt the economy.
Also, a big classical music festival will soon arrive on the Central Coast with a unique way of doing things.
The setting that they're located in, the food, the wine, right. The whole idea. It's a very Central Coast, San Luis Obispo County idea.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 22nd, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. The Oceana Dunes State Vehicular Recreation Area, outside of the quiet beach town of Oceano, has been making headlines this summer following 6 deaths at the park this year. But the park remains very popular among the all-terrain vehicle crowd that enjoys weekend camping and driving. It's the last beach on the California coast that allows motor vehicles. For years, local residents have been complaining that the park creates noise and pollution. Others worry about the sensitive ecology of the dunes and the wildlife that lives there. The string of deaths at the park also has brought its use into question with authorities, leaving everyone to ask who or what deserves greater access to the beach. KCRW producer Pablo Pena recently visited the park and says it's nature versus culture.
With over 2 million visitors a year, the Oceana Dunes State Park is one of a kind. It's where thrill seekers can rip through the sand on a dirt bike, Mad Max style. Towering ridges of sand, some as high as 50 feet, dominate the beachside landscape. Walk along this stretch of beach and you'll see miles of campgrounds, trucks, and trailers waving all sorts of flags. There are American flags, Mexican flags, California flags, and yeah, even Confederate flags. But 6 people died in crashes at the dunes just this year, including 2 in July. Safety's on everyone's mind.
I'll give you a warning today for the off-highway vehicles. They do have to have a weapon flag.
On this day, Park Ranger Darren Parker makes a routine stop pulling over a dune buggy in the open area of the Oceano Dunes. The buggy driver is riding without a flag, which is a park safety violation. In the nearby town, people are split over how they feel about the park. Some believe vehicle access is an integral part of the town's culture and a major economic driver. Others say, along with safety concerns, it's damaging the environment.
The dunes are not just a pile of sand. They are an ecological niche. They are a habitat. They are an ecosystem.
Lucia Casalinovo has been living in Oceano for over 30 years. She stands near one of the 2 entrances to the park, where cars line up behind a small booth to get on the beach. Casalinovo says she's not opposed to vehicle access, but it's about time to limit that access.
It's all about access for all, yes. Then it should be also access for pedestrians. And it should be also access for other kinds of activities and recreation that is just not vehicles. They have taken over everything.
She also points to a couple of abandoned businesses near a small parking lot in front of the entrance. Tourism from the dunes, she says, is not doing much for the local economy. Complaints like these led to a recent Coastal Commission hearing on whether to limit how many vehicles can be on the dunes at one time. The Coastal Commission now allows 1,000 permits a day, and they want to reduce it to 700. They're also considering protecting a creek on the beach and the animals that live there from vehicle traffic. Those against the limits say they'll eventually lead to closing vehicle access, getting rid of long-standing traditions.
There have been camping trips there, barbecues, campfires, and so many family and teen events there.
San Luis Obispo County Supervisor Lynn Compton says closing the dunes could change the entire nature of her district.
Our county is dependent on tourism and the economy. The economic impact of losing this recreational area would no doubt hurt the economy.
Others, like Off-Highway Vehicle Commissioner Ted Cabral, support vehicle access, but say some things need to change. Cabral, not speaking for the commission, but for himself, says it's all about professionalism, like improving vehicle entry to the dunes.
the signage is terrible, the kiosks, the safety kiosk, the information stuff, the safety programs, all types of stuff like that are things that, you know, that's the things I first look at when I go into a place.
Meanwhile, those who do want to limit vehicle access say traffic at the dunes contributes to some of the poorest air quality in the country, just a few miles inland for homes on the nearby Nipomo Mesa. Fast-moving vehicles also threaten wildlife such as the snowy plover and the California least tern, both endangered birds that make the dunes their home. Then, there's the impact on residents of the town. With a high poverty rate and low median income, some groups say business from the dunes doesn't benefit them all that much. Cynthia Rapogel represents the Oceano Beach Community Association.
It's an environmental justice issue, an economic justice issue, to have something like the ODSVRA operating right next to our community and preventing us from having a safe beach and preventing us from using our main beach street as other beach cities do.
The Coastal Commission gave local officials 1 year to come up with a new plan for the Oceano Dunes. For now, it's as busy as ever at the park. And permits to drive on the dunes are sold out every weekend for this summer.
That was KCRW's Pablo Pena reporting for KCRW Podcast, The 805. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Morro Bay is home to an Army Air Force rescue crash boat that's open for tours on the waterfront. It's run by the Morro Bay Maritime Museum. Correspondent Tom Wilmer recently spoke with the museum's operation manager about the historical boat, as well as some of the museum's other nautical stars, including a deep-sea rescue submarine and a tugboat that was a hero of World War II when it rescued survivors of an oil tanker sunk by a Japanese submarine 4 miles off the coast of Cambria.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Morro Bay, California. Right now we're on the waterfront in Morro Bay. During World War II, Morro Bay was a major training depot for the United States Navy, training for amphibious landings. During the war, both Avila Beach and Morro Bay was visited by a high-speed crash boat that was operated by the Army Air Force. The mission of the crash boat was to rescue downed pilots. By some miracle, one of the crash boats survives in pristine condition, and Morro Bay has been blessed to have it come visit, and it is now here for a while. We're here with Larry Newland.
I'm the operations manager for the Morro Bay Maritime Museum, which, by the way, is right across the street from where we're docked right now.
Across the street at the Maritime Museum, you have some incredible static displays.
We do. We have right out in front, it's pretty hard to miss, the DSRV, the Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicle Avalon, one of two that were built during the Cold War for the U.S. Navy.
Basically a mini submarine, a rescue submarine.
It is. It's a rescue submarine to rescue crews from downed nuclear submarines. And they built two of them, the Mystic and the Avalon, and the Avalon is here. It's been here on display for a number of years, on loan from the Navy History and Heritage Command in Washington, D.C.
There's also a tugboat that precedes World War II, and during the dawning days of World War II, it became a hero right here on the Central Coast.
It did. The Alma, the vessel Alma, launched in 1927 near Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, really gained its fame on the morning of December 23, 1941, when it dashed out from the Cayucas Pier looking for survivors from the sunken Union oil tanker Montebello.
And the Montebello was torpedoed and sunk by a Japanese submarine.
Probably a little north of Cambria, but a little south of Piedras, about 6 miles offshore. The I-21 submarine, one of nine such B-class submarines that were part of the flotilla from Pearl Harbor, tracked her and sunk her with one torpedo. And the Montebello rests on the seafloor at 880 feet today.
To this day, it's sitting on the bottom of the ocean. And that's one of the stories that's to a point untold, in that it was loaded with oil, which is still on board. And that is a future environmental issue.
Well, that was investigated. Not that long ago, there was a coalition of folks put together by Assemblyman Sam Blakesley. And as far as we can tell, the crude oil that it was carrying either dissipated or leaked out slowly, but it does not appear at this time as though it's an impending ecological disaster.
So we got way off track as to why I came to see you today. And that's because of the newest visitor to Morro Bay, the World War II Army Air Force crash rescue boat.
Yeah, the P-520 that we're sitting on is one of 140 85-foot models of U.S. Army Air Force crash rescue boats. They were actually called PRBs, patrol rescue boats. The initial version was 63 feet long, but then this 85-foot version is more or less a scaled-up version of the 63-footers. It's interesting to note that we know that there were some 63-footers based in Morro Bay, probably not 85-footers. However, this boat was based in Avila Beach for 5 or 6 months during World War II.
Have you met any locals that are still alive that remember the crash boats being here?
No, I have not. And in fact, there's a U.S. Crash Boat Association, and the director of that, the fellow that manages that in their website, who rode up from Long Beach with us, said that there are very few crash boat veterans from World War II or even Korea that are still around.
Interesting. So the crash boats, I know they were stationed in Alaska, out in the Aleutians. There were some in the South Pacific, the West Coast. Where else were they?
The Western Pacific, South Pacific, Alaska, the Eastern Seaboard, and the Gulf States. Domestically, where there was an Army Air Force base or air operations near the water, they would post these near the runways, much like you see an ambulance at a football game, because essentially these boats were high-speed floating ambulances from the 1940s. They were meant to go fast and pick up downed aircrew.
And I've done some research on the Alaska guys, and one of the huge complaints of the crew members was that they weren't insulated, and they just froze to death, and they prayed to God they were out for a short period of time.
Yeah, they weren't comfortable for those kinds of conditions. And in fact, they designed a 104-foot model. Most of those were dispatched to Alaska because they were a little more comfortable, crew comforts and such. They were slower than this, and they didn't build as many of those. But they used these 85s in Korea, but they weren't used for rescue purposes. They were used for inserting special operations troops behind enemy lines north of the Yalu River.
A visual picture, the closest thing I can liken a crash boat to is a PT boat, kind of that profile and that fast look to it.
They resemble that at first glance, but when you start peeling back the layers of the onion, they really have nothing to do with the PT boat. So they were not PT boats that were modified.
That profile.
The profile
is very similar.
They have that look. They were 5 feet longer than most of the PT boats. The PT boats were 72 and 80 feet, mostly made by Elko, some by Higgins. The people that had the influence on this hull design were the British and the South Africans.
Oh, interesting. Wow. So a real worldwide effort.
It was, and it was really the British that pioneered the use of having integrated marine units in their air force back in the 1920s. But of course, with the Battle of Britain in, you know, June through the fall of 1940, it really became imperative for them to be able to pick up their pilots out of the English Channel, and they were quite successful with their boats, which were called Vospers.
The crash boat, its reason for existence is all about speed. That being said, the power plant, talk to us about the engines that drive this vessel.
Well, that's one thing they had in common with the PT boats. They were originally designed to have two Packard 12-cylinder engines that put out anywhere between 12 and 1,500 horsepower each. They would burn high-octane fuel or avgas, maybe 100 octane. For your listeners that fly small airplanes with a high combustion engine, you need to increase the octane. And there was a designer at Packard who designed their marine engine line, but most of those engines went for PT boats. So the crash boat program was sort of the poor stepchild that had to wait in line to get its share of the Packard motors.
The top speed in pursuit of a downed pilot would be approximately what?
About 35 knots, plus or minus.
So 40 plus miles per hour?
Approximately. But of course, it could vary with the boat. It could vary with how much weight. It could vary with the seas tremendously. A cruising speed was about 24 knots, perhaps. And at that speed, it would burn about 140 gallons per hour of this high-octane gasoline.
There must be huge fuel tanks on board.
It carries now about 3,000 gallons of diesel fuel because, of course, it's been repowered with two diesel engines.
So you need a credit card to gas it up.
Yes, you do. When we came up here from Long Beach, I'm guessing we burned somewhere between 350 and 400 gallons of fuel, doing 12 knots from Long Beach to Morro Bay.
The crash boat, how long at this point in time, I know this is all new, work in progress, do you imagine the crash boat to be stationed here?
Well, the plan right now is for it to be here through the Morro Bay Harbor Festival.
It's October.
That's always the first weekend of October. So this year, I think that's the 6th and 7th. This year, it's a two-day Harbor Festival, and we're looking forward to that. Long term, we haven't made any plans. You know, for any museum to have something in the water, a floating stock, a floating exhibit, it's really a crucial business decision. You know, a wooden boat, even a highly restored wooden boat, is still a wooden boat in the water.
Back to the vessel itself, one of the most impressive sights walking up is the 250 caliber machine guns. Was that standard defensive armament on board?
It was. The armament changed and evolved over time. Originally, these barbettes, or the so-called gun tubs, had dual 50 calibers on each side. For a while, they put a quad 50 caliber on the bow, and they even, for a while, on some of the boats, not this particular boat, had a 20 millimeter Oerlikon autocannon in the back here near the stern. But that weighed so much and put so much downward pressure on the stern that it impeded performance, and it was really antithetical to the purpose of the boat, which was, again, high-speed ambulance.
Get in, get out.
Yes, yes.
So that being said, there were never depth charges on board either.
Not this one. There's a picture of one of the 63s mounted with some depth charges on the back on kind of a davit system that held a few of them. But this really wasn't an offensive weapon. This was a weapon for rescue and in Korea for inserting troops quickly and efficiently.
So here we are on the waterfront, directly below the Harbor Hut.
And I want to put a plug in for those folks. If it wasn't for the Harbor Hut and the sport fishing folks here for the Endeavor and the other owners here, Mr. Fowler, those folks came together and made this available. It's not easy finding a spot.
Who pays the mortgage?
Well, right now it's a combination of the Tourism Board and the Maritime Museum. This had to come together very quickly, and again, I want to commend the folks here that run the dock that wasn't for them, we couldn't pull this off.
They probably like a great view for the diners.
I think so, and that was one of the selling points that I tried to point out to them, and especially on 4th of July when we fired off the guns.
So talk to us a little bit about that, because your 50 caliber anti-aircraft armament are fully functional, and you have these great rounds made by Hollywood.
Yeah, these are two simulator 50 caliber Brownings, a design that goes back to John Browning after the World War I, still in use today. The basic design is variants of it. These particular guns were made by a gentleman in Hollywood who makes special effects, and they run on propane and compressed air, and they're electric. And
so there's a flash and smoke.
Yes. And they're quite loud.
You got the sheriffs out on you, didn't you?
We did. Well, we gave good notice to everybody, including the Morro Bay PD, but apparently that didn't get transferred to the sheriff's dispatch in San Luis Obispo. So what we did for 4th of July is we gave them a schedule about three times when we were going to fire, and that seemed to work okay. And we got pretty good applause up here on the street.
I bet, yeah.
And 4th of July evening, pretty good muzzle flash, pretty good fireworks. People could hear them all the way across town.
This is open to the public for onboard tours, correct?
That's correct. We're open for the remainder of the summer until further notice. It'll be Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, about 10 to 3. $6 for adults, $4 for youth, and then under 6 is free, youth being 6 to 12.
And a senior rate?
There's no senior rate, but it's free for active or retired military with ID. We're limited by the Coast Guard for the time being of only having 12 paying passengers on at a time.
Even though it's tied up?
Even though it's tied up. Under the Coast Guard rules, the Code of Federal Regulations, a passenger is anybody who pays money to step foot on a boat, whether or not it's underway or tied up at the dock.
One of your most beneficial fundraising enterprises might be to take people out on cruises.
We thought about that, but, you know, operating the boat has its own set of complications. It's a gas guzzler, 1 gallon per mile per engine. As you can see, it doesn't have handrails like a traditional passenger boat.
So you could lose a few.
Well, you'd have to be really on it. I mean, this boat was set up for GIs, and it's not set up for civilian passengers.
So doubtful that there'll be cruises out in the bay.
Anytime soon. Yeah, that's true.
Larry Newland, thank you for sharing. What a great day.
Thanks, and come on down, and if you want information, go to the museum. Tickets and all the information about this is at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum, 1210 Embarcadero, right across the street from where we're at, and by the South Tee Pier.
The icon would be the stacks.
Yeah, in between. The stacks are just north of us. There's a large paved parking lot. It's pretty hard to miss. There's a big green submarine on a trailer out in front with an orange canopy. It's pretty hard to miss.
And a website?
MorroBayMaritime.org.
Larry, thanks again.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the waterfront in Morro Bay, California.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Festival Mosaic starts this Wednesday. It's one of the biggest music festivals on the Central Coast, and it runs through August 4th at various venues throughout San Luis Obispo County, featuring primarily music that fits under the classical umbrella. And I'm happy to have Festival Mosaic's music director and its brand new executive director with me today. Welcome Scott Yu and Lloyd Tanner.
Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Lloyd, you've been in the job as executive director for a little over a month now. Talk about jumping into the deep end right before the festival begins.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's all hands on deck. We're ready to go.
Okay, and you're no stranger to performing arts management. You held senior positions with LA Opera, Washington National Opera, Washington Ballet, and many others. What drew you to Festival Mosaic?
You know, I've been very fortunate to work for some incredible organizations throughout my career. It is something that I've been blessed to experience. When I began my career as an arts administrator at the Atlanta Symphony, I never imagined that I would travel to the various places that I've been able to, experience some incredible music and performances that will last a lifetime. But I think this all sort of culminated with taking on different aspects of the work that you have to learn to be a great arts administrator, and then finally realizing that it was time for me to put all those pieces together and take leadership in an organization. And whenever Festival Mosaic was looking for an executive director, it sort of all came at the right time for me, both personally and professionally.
And not only that, you have somebody who you love very much who got a job in San Luis Obispo County. So
exactly,
it all fell together perfectly for
yes.
you, didn't it?
You know, my wife landing a job at Cal Poly as the costume shop manager and teaching costuming, it all came together at the right time.
I expect that this festival for you is largely about learning Festival Mosaic, the festival itself, the organization, and also the community. So what are some of the things that you're focusing on as you step into the director role?
You mentioned, you know, all of that is very true. For me, this is a new experience. I haven't experienced the festival in its, you know, completion ever. So I'm looking forward to that experience. But it is really how, as I look at it, you know, how are we engaging the community? How are we engaging our audience? What is it that they really love about the festival? What is it that they would love to see more of, and how do we incorporate that into future seasons?
And Scott, you, as music director, how do you collaborate with the executive director?
It's easy with somebody like Lloyd because he's a brilliant person, really nice person, so it's going to be fun. It's really fun to get someone else's take on work that you do all the time because they'll see something that you don't see.
So bringing fresh ideas, different perspective, and then working together to tweak some things or maybe change some things wholesale as you move along.
And also, I think that Lloyd, because he's worked in so many different places, he's able to understand a cultural organization's place not only in the community of San Luis Obispo, but also the community of California and the community of the United States, and sort of understanding what do we need to be doing, which direction should we be going in. I think Lloyd is uniquely equipped to handle that issue. Mm-hmm. And that's really great for us right now.
And can you, Lloyd, give us some examples of how you're uniquely equipped to handle that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what Scott's alluding to is the relationship between administrative and the artistic side of an arts organization. That collaboration of making sure that we're fiduciary responsible to the board, to our community, but then also bringing forth some of the most amazing artists from around the country, international artists as well, to our community, and making sure that as we look into future seasons that we're planning what we believe the audience is going to want to attend, but also exposing them to things that they may have not even thought of attending before. So I think that's the nice balance between having the experience, having several opportunities to be a part of some really interesting organizations, but then, you know, bringing that all together for here in San Luis Obispo.
Scott, you pick a theme each year that ties together the concerts and the music that we hear. And this year it's music of the old world, exploring how early music influences what we hear through to the present. Can you talk about that and tell us what we should be looking for?
And particularly music from the Iberian Peninsula. Domenico Scarlatti was born in 1685, same year as Bach and Handel, kind of a banner crop of composers that year. And unlike Bach and Handel, I remember the first time I heard Scarlatti, I remember thinking, is this some modern composer? Who is this guy? And then it was actually my girlfriend's father said, oh, this is Scarlatti. This is piano sonatas of Scarlatti. And I thought, oh my God, this is just crazy. How come I've never heard this music? Anyway, the reason Scarlatti was so different was that his music was colored by the music of Spain and Moorish music and Sephardic music, because that was where he worked. He worked in Madrid. So I thought it would be really interesting, because people like Bartok, people like Brahms, just tons and tons of composers were influenced by Scarlatti's music. So I thought, oh, it would be so interesting to do a sort of a family tree from the Iberian Peninsula and see how it stretches. I'm involved in a project with PBS, and we did an episode on Scarlatti. And we bumped into a wonderful flamenco dancer named Ileana Gomez, who appears on the show. She's coming to the Central Coast. We play part of Canarios, which is a Iberian folk song. That folk song will appear on a guitar concerto that we're performing at the Summer's Festival. So I thought it would be very interesting to sort of see how far. You know, they say that you sneeze in one. Wait, what is it? You blow
something about a sneeze, butterfly.
The wings of a butterfly flap, yep. And it causes a hurricane four states over. You have one composer visit one part of the world in the early 18th century, and how that changes all of music for all time. It's interesting.
Yeah. It must take you all year to come up with the threads that connect each concert to the theme and each piece to the theme.
It takes a really long time just to come up with the theme, actually. That's sort of the hardest, because you can say, okay, let's do music on butterflies. And then you could, you know, pick this piece and this piece and this piece, and then, but you don't have enough for a festival. Or you could pick, let's just do German composers. Well, that's so not specific enough. Let's do music on French composers. Let's do music on Belgian composers. Okay, there's not enough to fill an entire festival mosaic season. So coming up with the right theme is difficult. And then after that, sometimes it sort of threads its own needle.
So the common denominator being Scarlatti and the Iberian Peninsula. Now, Scarlatti, didn't he write like over 500...
555 sonatas, and they all follow roughly the same form. It's sort of a binary form, meaning there's a part A and a part B, and part A and part B are roughly the same and the same length, but they are all so different. Some of them imitate flamenco steps. Some of them imitate the Spanish guitar. There were chords in some Scarlatti sonatas that have 12 notes in them. I don't know any piano piece that has 12-note chords. You only have 10 fingers. But the way it's written is for you to use your thumb to hit two notes at a time. Mm. I mean, this is a guy who was writing music before this country was born. And he's coming up with these things that are really revolutionary and kind of crazy. And we're doing Bartok's Third String Quartet, which is modeled after one of Scarlatti's piano sonatas. It's just interesting to see how far from the tree the apple fell in this case.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking today with the Festival Mosaic music director and its brand new executive director, Scott Yu and Lloyd Tanner. So you have these notable encounters. Mm-hmm. They're dinners and lunches where you kind of explain and share with the audience how a certain concert comes together, how we should be listening to the music, what we should be listening mm-hmm. for, and how it threads in.
They truly are what I would consider the signature events that Festival Mosaic does.
We do them in not that many. You don't get that experience in so many places.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It truly is a unique way of presenting music, not only in a concert form, but the setting that they're located in, the mm-hmm. food, the wine, right. the whole idea. It's a very Central Coast, San Luis Obispo County idea. I mean, like it wouldn't work in Los Angeles. It would feel fake. It truly is a very, very slow thing.
Most of those are sold out, but this one about Bartok coming up at the Dalla Day Adobe on July 27th. Tell me a little bit about what people might expect at something like that.
They're going to have brunch, and they're going to be seated with the musicians, which is pretty unusual. You don't usually go to a concert and eat with the performers before they play, but that's what we do here. And then they're going to give the audience a museum docent's guide, a tour of Bartok's Third String Quartet, which is actually a piece I don't know well. I've never played it. But the person who's leading it is in a quartet. Her name is Caitlin Lynch. She's a violist. And she is going to talk about how Bartok put this piece together and specifically Scarlatti's influence on the piece because it was actually modeled after a Scarlatti sonata. Should be fascinating. I'm going to attend it, so I'm going to learn.
Oh, it sounds fascinating. You also have your chamber series. You have orchestra concerts. There are so many different types of concerts that we can expect and events that we can expect. There's the unclassical series. Tell me a little bit about the unclassical series and why it exists as a part of the festival.
Well, the unclassical series used to be called the Fringe series, and it was modeled after Edinburgh's Fringe Festival. And I like to think of it this way. We're trying to present a large tent, and the higher the big top is, the more area you cover. So we want to afford our listeners the most points of entry into the art form. Some people who don't have as much of a classical background or are not as interested in maybe sort of traditional Western art music, they might want to go hear a concert that is played by people who were trained classically but then branched out. And that's basically the philosophy behind, quote, unclassical, meaning classically trained musicians who've now gone off and done different things.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll hear more from Marisa Waddell's conversation with Scott Yu and Lloyd Tanner of Festival Mosaic about some of the festival's other musical offerings. Stay with us. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Before the break, KCBX's Marisa Waddell was in conversation with Scott Yu and Lloyd Tanner of Festival Mosaic. It's one of the Central Coast's largest music festivals. It kicks off Wednesday and runs through August 4th. It mostly falls under the umbrella of classical music, but there are all kinds of music and activities to take in at this year's fest.
So one of the fringe events that you mentioned is the flamenco evening with Ileana Gomez at the Dana Adobe in Nipomo. That's coming up on Friday, July 26th. Tell me a little bit what we might expect at something like that.
Well, Ileana Gomez is a very interesting woman. She is of Mexican heritage. She grew up in Texas. She's actually an American citizen. but she is one of Madrid's leading flamenco dancers, which when I met Ileana, we were shooting a scene with her in Madrid, and someone explained to me how rare it was that somebody who is not Spanish would rise to such prominence in the Madrid flamenco scene. I mean, she's one of the top people. And when we were watching her, I must confess, I had never seen flamenco dance live before. I'd seen it on TV, but I realized this is not just dance, this is music too. I mean, she is a percussionist with her feet. And it was the most we've seen a lot of mesmerizing things shooting this TV show, but that was the most mesmerizing thing I've ever seen on it. It was shocking.
And the TV show that you're talking about is the one that you are host and executive producer for on PBS. It's called Now Hear This.
Right. And that'll start airing this September. And Ileana appears on the Scarlatti episode, and she just stole the show. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. And I couldn't wait to attempt to get her to the Central Coast.
One of the other unclassical series concerts is at the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande. That's coming up on Thursday, August 1st. It's a group called Take Three. Tell me a little bit about them.
So Take Three is a piano trio. They're three young, extremely precocious women who they do covers of jazz and rock standards. I have tried to do stuff like that. It's really hard, and they're very, very good. So I'm really looking forward to that show. That's going to be at the Clark Center.
And that's a piano trio, which is violin, cello, and piano, right?
Violin, cello, and piano. So you're used to hearing a piano trio play Beethoven or Tchaikovsky or something. So to hear them play Led Zeppelin or Rolling Stones or something, I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
You even have an element for children at the festival, and you have free events throughout the 2 weeks of Festival Mosaic.
So the children's concert is something new for us this year. We're going to be doing the Carnival of Animals, but we're going to have dancers from the Movement Arts Center. And we're going to throw this huge party, basically, for children Monday, July 29th at 11 in the morning. And my friend Dan Shadwell, who is very well known in this area because he was on TV so much, he's going to be narrating, and I'll be playing in the orchestra. And I'll also be sort of the MC, I guess. I'll show the kids the different instruments that we play, how a piano works, how a flute works, and so forth. And I hope that this will be a nice introduction for children, if this might be somebody's first concert that they see.
And what are some of the other free events that are throughout the festival?
Yeah, all throughout the festival, we have what we call our midday series. And these are recitals that are given by many of the musicians that are coming. If you go to Festival Mosaic, that's festivalmozaic.com, you can take a look at our calendar and find those free events that are all throughout the county.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell. My guests today are the music director of Festival Mosaic, Scott Yu, and its new executive director, Lloyd Tanner. Who are some of the soloists that you're excited about presenting this year?
So in 2016, I played a Schubert quartet for guitar, flute, viola, and cello. I never heard of the piece before. And it was with this young guitarist named Robert Belnich, and I was bowled over by this person because this person was like, it felt like playing with a great violinist or a great pianist or something. He was so cultured and such a warm musician, and I thought, I've got to work with this person again. So when we decided to do Rodrigo's Fantasy on a Gentleman, I thought, we got to try Robert Belnich, because let's see if he plays the piece, because he was so wonderful. And so I'm really excited that we're going to get him. We're doing that concert at Cuesta College in their Performing Arts Center with our fabulous, fabulous orchestra. And I just can't wait to hear that combination. A few days earlier, my good friend Jonah Kim, who in my opinion is one of the best cellists around right now, he's going to be playing the Haydn Cello Concerto No. 1, actually a recently discovered cello concerto. I think it was discovered in the 50s or 60s. And my good friend Fei Shi, who is the principal bassoonist of the Minnesota Orchestra, and widely recognized as one of the, you know, three or four best bassoonists there is right now. He's just the top of the heap. He's going to play the Mozart Bassoon Concerto. And one of the really fun things about our festival is that it is populated with so many strong musicians that we can just sort of close our eyes, point a finger, and that person could do a fantastic concerto for us. And we use everyone.
So anybody in the orchestra might have a chance to be a featured soloist the next year.
Yes, and the idea actually is hopefully everybody gets a chance. I mean, we really have one of the people coming this summer, Grace Park. She's been coming for several years. She just won first prize in the Naumburg International Violin Competition. Another young violinist named Abigail Kralik. I think she's probably one of the two or three best violinists in her generation. She's 20 years old, but I wish I could play like she did. She's just absolutely phenomenal. So I'm really excited about the people that we're going to share with our Central Coast friends.
What does a day in the life of a festival musician look like? And what is the feel of a summer festival for the musicians?
We kind of have the reputation of being the nice festival. So when people show up here, they'll say to me on day three or day four, yeah, now I understand. And I say, well, what do you mean? Oh, everybody says that everybody's so nice here. You know, people usually get started at 10 for a rehearsal, and then we'll hustle and get lunch somewhere fast. Another rehearsal at 2:15, hustle and have dinner quickly. And then there's either a concert that night or another rehearsal. And then the next day is the same. I mean, it is pretty intense. Usually after the concerts, people have some kind of a party, go to a restaurant or, you know, have dinner together. So people are really burning the candle at both ends. I mean, we'll go to bed at midnight and we'll say, we'll see you in 7 hours because we'll see. I mean, you're practically living with each other. Mm-hmm. It's very intense.
And that's a lot of music to learn.
It's a lot of music. And with some summer festivals, I think one difference here is that with some summer festivals, they will not play the string quartet repertoire for good reason. I'm not saying that's not a good idea. It's so difficult. You know, it takes months and months and months to perfect a string quartet. At our festival, we play everything because we feel that our audience wants to hear it. So what that will mean is that we'll rehearse like a string quartet. So instead of having two rehearsals for a piece of music, we'll have six or seven or eight rehearsals. And so that makes people busier.
There is a lot more than music that goes behind putting on a festival like this. There are volunteers, there's funding. It takes more than just ticket sales to run Festival Mosaic. What do you need as a festival?
I think that's one of the great things about my position within the organization is that I do get to sort of be the spokesperson and be the sort of public face for all of our volunteers who help us out. We would not be able to do any of the Festival Mosaic without the countless numbers of hours that they put in assisting each performance with selling concessions and just being that warm face that greets you each time you come to a performance. Our team and staff that we have as part of the festival are some of the best that I've ever worked with. Makes my job and Scott's job much easier because we don't have to worry about every little last detail. Bringing in 50 musicians from around the country, housing each of those, care and feeding, watering, and then some, really does take a great community to come together to make that all possible. But I would be remiss without saying that it is our board who is the backbone of our support. It is our donors, both individual, corporate, and the foundation support that we receive that really makes that all possible. You know, the tickets only do cover a portion of what it costs to put this festival on, and we do rely on the generosity of our community to make sure that it's, you know, it's thriving and successful.
And I would like to add to that that a big element in putting this festival on is actually the city itself. It's beautiful here. People are very nice here. There are delicious things to eat here. That's a huge part of it. It's a huge subsidizer, if you will, of our festival.
And I think that's the important thing that we try to use in the festival is with all the different locations that we have, ranging from Chapel Serra up in Shandon, down to Napomo, out to Cambria, in San Luis Obispo proper. I think that is what does truly make us embrace our community as much as we want the community to embrace us.
Great. I'm Marisa Waddell. This is Issues and Ideas, and my guests have been Scott Yu, who's the music director of Festival Mosaic, and Lloyd Tanner, who's the new executive director. The festival runs this coming Wednesday, July 24th through August 4th, and you can find the details at festivalmosaic.com. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Marisa.
Good afternoon, Tyler Pratt here on Issues and Ideas. One more music event for your radar. Maybe more of a trek, depending on where you live on the Central Coast. The Ken Burns Country Music Roadshow is stopping this week in the San Joaquin Valley, with shows in Fresno and in Bakersfield. It's part of a national tour to preview and discuss his most recent long-form documentary, Country Music. KVPR's Alice Daniel recently spoke with Burns about the role the San Joaquin Valley plays in what composer Harlan Howard described as three chords and the truth.
You're likely the most well-known documentary filmmaker in the U.S. with more than 30 exhaustively reported and researched films under your belt, including ones on baseball, the Vietnam War, and jazz. Was country music an obvious next choice for you?
Well, you know, these projects take many, many years. Vietnam took 10 and a half years to make. Our one on the history of the Second World War took 7 years. The national parks took 10 as well. So there's a lot of overlap. I knew I was going to be doing country music back in 2010. Early 2011, when we had barely started shooting the Vietnam film. So many of these are overlapping for many, many years. So it's not like the next thing is the perfect thing. It's that the story of country music is a perfect subject. I'm in the business of telling stories. My stories happen to be in American history, but that's the way a painter might choose oil as opposed to watercolor, choose to do still lifes instead of landscapes. I choose to do stuff in American history, but it's all stories.
Out of the 16 and a half hours of storytelling we get with country music, what's a story that just sticks with you, something you can't stop thinking about?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and it's germane to my conversation with you and to your audience, and that's Merle Haggard. I knew about him. I knew his centrality to the music, but I didn't know how important it was. And then as we began to research the details of his remarkable story, we were very fortunate. Out of the 101 interviews that we did for the series, probably 80 of them are in the film. 20 have passed away, including Merle, but we were so fortunate to get him before he passed away. And his wisdom and his insights and his thoughtfulness about what a good story and a good song mean, and he's one of the great singer-songwriters of all time, regardless of genre, and what some of the early influences he had. So he's equally as effective talking about the Maddox Brothers and Rose, also from the Central Valley, talking about Lefty Frizzell, talking about various people who were inspirations for him. Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys in the days of the 30s country western swing.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Bob Wills. He was a fiddle player with his band, the Texas Playboys. They blended jazz horn sections and swing rhythms with traditional fiddle music into a style that became known as western swing. He moved to Fresno with his band at the height of his popularity to be closer to Hollywood and to own a horse ranch. For people who aren't familiar with his music, how significant was he as an artist?
Oh, he's really important, and he helps to remind people who may not know about country music. They may love it or they may hate it, but they may not know that much about its history, that it's never been one thing. The Big Bang, as country music folks refer to the creation of it, occurs in the summer of 27 when an entrepreneur named Ralph Peer records in successive weeks the Carter family, which is the epitome of home and mother and the church, the kind of Sunday morning values, and then Jimmy Rogers the next week, who is most definitely a rogue and a scamp and bringing the blues out of the deep, deep South, who's very much Saturday night. And to which then country music expanded even further and did cowboy stuff, did Western swing, did the Bakersfield sound as it emerged, did bluegrass and other string evolutions. And so it's never been one thing. And I think we have to understand that swing music was the soundtrack of America. I think jazz swing represented 75% of all records sold in the 30s and early 40s. And so what you see is that country music is ever adapting. And Bob Wills, out of Texas, wanted to swing in Oklahoma, wanted to swing the way Louis Armstrong and Chick Webb and Fletcher Henderson and Duke Ellington and Benny Goodman and others were swinging in jazz. And he just came from different roots, so he added different instruments, but the rhythm, the propulsion is the same. And it shows you that all of our categorizing, all of the boundaries between different categories don't actually exist to the musicians. I mean, you've got people who are influenced by the jazz stylings of Django Reinhardt, like Chester Atkins, the great guitar player who came to Nashville with the Carter family. You've got Willie Nelson, who still phrases unlike anyone else in country music and owes more to jazz. So jazz, rhythm and blues, the blues, country, rock and roll, they are all so intertwined.
I'm curious, what are some of the similar roots that jazz and country music share?
They share the kind of conversation that African Americans and other European Americans have been having in the South for centuries. The banjo, the classic instrument of an early country band, is an African instrument. The fiddle is, of course, from Europe and the British Isles. And so that conversation between the traditions of the Scotch, Irish, Welsh, English ballads and the blues are very much intertwined in country music. So you would take some of the earlier celebrated heroes of it, A.P. Carter of the Carter family, Jimmy Rogers, who I just described, Hank Williams, the great, perhaps the greatest of all country people, Johnny Cash, and Bill Monroe, the founder of bluegrass music. Every single one of those men had an African-American mentor who took their chops from here to up here, and it's reflected in the music. So it's a wonderful story to tell because it reminds us that at the heart of this are people who are hungry. What's so surprising is that everybody, whether it's Merle Haggard or Buck Owens or the Maddox Brothers and Rose, are coming from abject poverty, not just Depression-era poverty, but poverty before the Depression and after the Depression. Dolly Parton's father paid the doctor who came to the holler to deliver her in East Tennessee with a sack of cornmeal. I mean, she was on TV before her family could own a TV.
Let's return to Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. Their music was often dramatically different. What for you defines the Bakersfield sound, and how do you think Buck and Merle differ from each other?
Well, that's a really wonderful question. I think it's got a kind of a driving beat. It's a post-war sound that's got some insistent to it. It's electrified. It's a little bit different from, and sometimes a lot different from the smoother sound that Nashville was producing at the time. And so it's got an edge. And even though Buck Owens isn't talking about the things, his voice, as Dwight Yoakam, another inheritor of that in our film, describes, the voice has an insistence. You know, tiger by the tail. I've got a tiger by the tail. It's plain to see, you know, and it goes on like that. Merle is called the poet of the common man. Like Hank Williams, who is the hillbilly Shakespeare, Merle understands about life. And so the songs that he writes are from his own experience, some of prison, some of the loneliness that came from that, from heartbreak, from rediscovering love. All of that is an important part of his. And so I think there's more heartache, in Merle's work, even though Buck has got all of that defiance in it. He's singing, as Dwight says in our film, for every Okie, every Arkie, every Texan that came to the Central Valley and was, you know, discriminated against all under the moniker Okies when they first arrived.
When we talk about the Bakersfield sound, was it just the result of Children of the Dust Bowl migration, or was something else at work?
I think there's always lots of things at play, but I think certainly the experiences of the Dust Bowl, the diaspora that it created of hundreds of thousands of Americans. Remember, there was a drought in 46 of the 48 states, so everybody was called an Okie, whether they came from Oklahoma or not, and they all migrated to what they thought would be the promised land, and of course ran into a desire not to welcome new immigrants. Sounds familiar. And that just repeats itself over and over again. So I think that experience, and let's remember this is during the Depression, so it's the poverty combined with the ecological disaster of the Dust Bowl combined with this migration that is going to be helpful in it. But it's also, as I said, a kind of post-World War II demand for something new, the beginning of electrification, the honky-tonks and the roadhouses that are filling the Central Valley and the oil production that's going on there. So you're having a different kind of demand.
So you mentioned sort of the evolution of all these genres. I'm wondering if rock and roll is one of your next documentaries.
Well, you know, I've thought about that, and people have asked me to do rock and roll for a long time, even before I did A History of Jazz that came out in 2001. I don't think so right now. I mean, I was really content to take jazz and spend many, many years working on that, and then to spend 8 or so years working on country music. But never say never, you know.
As you've said, country music is very much about storytelling, driven in part by the tensions that have shaped American history itself. While the storytelling makes it relatable, I wonder if it's also the storytelling that pigeonholes it for some people who don't understand its breadth and its influence.
Well, I think it gets pigeonholed because of snobbery. I think people say, oh, country music is, you know, just a minor art form. And it doesn't have the sophistication and the complication of classical music or some forms of jazz. But the composer, Harlan Howard, called country music three chords and the truth. That means there's a kind of elemental musical form to it, just as there is in the blues, just as there is in folk music, just as there is in rock and roll. But you can hear the lyrics, and what are they about? All relatable things.
Let's talk about Merle Haggard's biggest commercial hit, which was Okie from Muskogee. It was often seen as a counter-protest to the anti-war movement, and yet Haggard in his later years was open that he smoked marijuana, and he spoke out against America's overseas wars. How significant was that song politically, and does it speak to some contradictions in country music?
Well, I think there's contradictions in everybody and in everything everywhere. Nobody is ever one thing. And I think for me, growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan in the 1960s, we loved Okie from Muskogee for its kind of meta meaning. You know, we laughed at it. What we learned later was that, of course, Merle and everybody on his bus smoked marijuana, and that was just inspired. It did get appropriated by the counter movement to the counterculture, so that the anti-Vietnam War movement sparred a response to them, not so much because they supported the war, but they didn't like what the hippies were doing. So when it got appropriated, then Merle kind of got, you know, grooved and pegged as this, but he outgrew it. He had already outgrown it. He'd transcended it. He was already the poet of the common man, and that was important. And I'm so happy that at the end of his life, he began to talk about the song in relationship to being proud of where you're from. Let's remember that while he's born in California, his family were Okies. And so I think we begin to see that quite often country music is a voice of people who don't feel like their stories are being told. And what's the genius of Merle Haggard is that he takes those stories and makes them universal. And I'm so happy that we're going to be able to be in Fresno and Bakersfield to sort of celebrate his and Buck's and the Maddox brothers and Rose and Bob Wills and Dwight Yoakam's legacy of understanding what the contribution of the Central Valley, what the contribution of the Bakersfield sound has made to not just country music, but to American music, world music, full stop, period.
Well, that sounds like a good place to end. Ken Burns, it's been a real honor to speak with you today. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much. Can't wait to see you all.
Again, Ken Burns and his Country Music Roadshow will be at the Soroyan Theater in Fresno, July 25th, and the Fox Theater in Bakersfield, July 26th.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.